Well, we are in Habakkuk, because that is where we left off. Habakkuk 3, specifically. And by the way, just to take a recognition here, we've made it through 4 out of the 12 minor prophets, which is pretty good. That's a third of them. Pretty impressive if you neglect that we've only chosen to do the short ones. And Hosea is 12 chapters, and Amos is 9, and you know we have a lot of Zechariah is 12 as well, or 14, sorry. So we kind of chose the easier, quicker ones, but we're going to get through all of them at some point. Today we're in Habakkuk 3, and just to remind you of what we've already studied, Habakkuk is a very unique book among the entirety of the Bible, and that is because it is a prophet having a dialogue with God. Habakkuk asks a question, God answers. Habakkuk asks another question, and God answers. Just a refresher for you is Habakkuk's first question was he looked around Judah. He looked around the people of God, and he saw wickedness. He saw corruption, injustice, oppression, sin, evil. And so his question to God was, why don't you do anything? Where are you, God, when the wicked prosper? And when it feels like being obedient to you is probably the worst choice you could make for yourself. God, why are you silent? He asks a very famous question, one that the Psalms will also ask. He asks, how long, O Lord? And God's answer is, well, I've actually been at work. I'm raising up the nation of Babylon, and they're going to actually punish those wicked people you're so concerned about. They're going to destroy Jerusalem, raise my temple to the ground. They're going to take the people of Israel into slavery, just like I promised in Deuteronomy. You can imagine that's not the answer Habakkuk hoped to hear. Habakkuk probably was thinking God would say, well, I'm going to raise up a king and he'll fix things. Instead, he's told that a foreign nation would totally destroy everything that he has ever known. So Habakkuk's second question is, God, how can you use a wicked nation to conquer us? Because my question remains, why do the wicked prosper? And God's final answer, which we read last time in Habakkuk 2, is that he shows Habakkuk a vision of the future where wrongs are made right, evil is punished, and God wins. What response Habakkuk has is recorded in chapter 3. This is not a question. This is the first time Habakkuk isn't asking a question of God. He is actually, if we look at Habakkuk chapter 3, verse 1, praying. Let's just read verse 1. A prayer of Habakkuk the prophet according to Shigionoth. A couple things to note is, well, first off, what is that last word? And that relates to what this entire sentence is. This is what we would call an ascription. You'll find them in the Psalms. A lot of times you'll find some Psalms that right at the beginning, and depending on your Bible translation, it might be italicized. It'll have this little blurb of a Psalm of David to the choir master, according to as the deer, or something like that. And what those are is they're original to the text. They're as inspired as every other part of Scripture. But they give a little bit of detail. What that does for us is that indicates that whatever Habakkuk is about to say, he intended for it to be written down, he intended for it to be sung, and it is intended for public worship, which you're going to find is kind of odd based on the reality of what he's describing. So this is a prayer. Habakkuk, in response to God's plan of action, he writes a prayer psalm. Let's go to Habakkuk 3, chapter 2. Why is he doing this? O Lord, I have heard the report of you, and your work, O Lord, do I fear. In the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. In wrath, remember mercy. Habakkuk has really changed over the course of this book. The Habakkuk of chapter 1 says, God, I think that you're looking at evil and you just aren't doing anything. But that seems weird because I know that you're a God who's just. He says, how long, O Lord? In Habakkuk chapter 2, at the last part of Habakkuk chapter 1, he starts to question, God, your plan doesn't match your character. he seems to want God to change plans. Now, in verse 2, we see that Habakkuk has changed. He has grown from this experience of talking to the Lord. Instead of asking him to change his plans, we notice in verse 2, in the midst of the years, revive it. In the midst of the years, make it known. This is intentional writing because the question we all have is, what is it? The tension builds. In the midst of the years, revive it. What is it? In the midst of years, make it known. What is it? And then finally we get it. In wrath, remember mercy. Habakkuk does not pray that the Lord would change his plans. He simply prays that the Lord would consistently be who he is in the midst of his plans. That the God who is promising wrath in the moment would remember that he is a God of mercy as well. And so what follows is one of the most impressive pieces of Hebrew poetry I've ever read. Because what it is a theophany. I know we're doing a lot of academic stuff at the beginning, but we have to be able to just be amazed by the rest of the book. A theophany is what we call it when an author uses kind of a mesh of just all of these images and symbols and pictures of God in human form to convey and evoke the emotion of experiencing the very presence of God. So what we have, we're going to see God moving and standing and attacking and fighting. There's going to be images from across the Bible, symbols of heaven and earth, and all of it is meant to make us be impacted with who God is. And all of it is actually going to be a description of the Exodus. You see, this is good for us to recognize that in the midst of troubled times, remembering what the Lord has already done on our behalf is going to help us to do what Habakkuk 2:4 says, the righteous shall live by faith. And so Habakkuk retells himself the story of the Exodus to remember, this is the God whom I'm trusting, even though things are about to get incredibly bad. That's what we are going to do as well, is look at the Exodus through this lens. So, we can break this down into three parts. The first part sees that God seeks his people. That's in verses 3 through 4. And then God defeats their enemies. That's verses 5 through 11. And then finally, God saves his people. That's 12 through 15. And then we'll look at that last section a little bit differently. Let's get into the text. In verse 3, God came from Teman, and the Holy One from Mount Paran. His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise. His brightness was like the light, rays flashed from his hand, and there he veiled his power. Again, we have to ask ourselves, what are these proper nouns, Teman and Mount Paran? Well, Teman is the area around the nation of Edom, which is just south of the Promised Land. And Mount Paran is associated with Sinai in the wilderness. And so we get something unexpected, a part of the story never revealed before. When we think of the Exodus, we think of God climactically choosing Moses and coming into Egypt and conquering and plagues and all of this. And Habakkuk says, well, let's take a step back. He pictures it as God hearing his people's cry from the Promised Land and going to get his people and bring them back. In the book of Exodus, one of God's main motivations for the plagues and the rescue and Passover and the entire Exodus journey and bringing the Israelites in the Promised Land is he will often say, I have heard my people's cries and I will come to them. Habakkuk takes that a step further and pictures it as if God's waiting in the Promised Land and he hears the cries of his people and he leaves the Promised Land, travels through Edom, through the Sinai wilderness, and goes to Egypt to save his people. Today's Palm Sunday, so it's worthwhile to make the connection that this is a characteristic of God that has not vanished when the Old Testament comes to a close. But Jesus will be incarnated, leaving heaven descending to live amongst people, and he will say of himself that the Son of Man seeks and saves the lost. A song I really like says, "You left your home to seek the lost." So God hears, and he travels to save his people. But why? Look at verse 3. "His splendor covered the heavens, and the earth was full of his praise." The word for praise here is not the normal Hebrew word for glory, kavod, which refers to God's weightiness, his heaviness as a matter. This is a word that can be used of people, of David, of Solomon. It's a word more akin to fame. So his fame, his greatness covers the heaven, and the earth is filled with his fame, his reputation. What we're finding here is that Habakkuk's thinking back on the motives of the Exodus. When God meets with Moses in the burning bush, he tells him two important things. "I heard the cry of my people, and I will get glory over Egypt, show Israel my goodness, and my name will be known among the nations." And so when we see the Exodus event, we see God making his name known and saving the people whose cries he heard. In verse 4, we move on. "His brightness was like the light, rays flashed from his hands, and there he veiled his power." Habakkuk is trying to describe the glory of the Lord. Whenever we come to texts that try to describe who God is in his essence, in his glory, we'll find that they all like one word more than any other. Like. When we look at Ezekiel, Ezekiel says, okay, let me explain this in detail. "God's throne is like stones, and his feet are like bronze. His face is like the sun. He's sitting on something that's like a rainbow. There's something like emeralds around there. And then there's also these things that are like living creatures. And there's something like a wheel." And you see how we like the word "like" because God is infinitely bigger than we can understand. And so Habakkuk chooses the same word as Ezekiel of brightness to say that the glory that is his splendor that is covering the heavens, his glory is like the sun itself in brilliance. Christian, for a moment, consider that if you look at the sun, that is less than, infinitely less than, the glory of the Lord. And I think we can say, okay, well, the sun's not that bright because we're so far from it and we have the ozone layer and all of that. The sun in all of its brilliance does not match the glory of the Lord that we have, who dwells with us, who loves us. And yet, even in that glory revealed, notice, there he veiled his power. Habakkuk seems to be having this image of even the majestic glory of the Lord that can make Isaiah say, "Woe is me, I am a man undone," who can make Ezekiel sit by the river Kebar for 7 days without speech because he is stunned by what he has seen. All of that glory, the glory that God says to Moses, "If you see it, you'll die." All of that glory is not even the whole thing. He is like a sun obscured by clouds. His glory is revealed, and yet it is obscured because he is infinite and we are finite. When we look at Isaiah's vision, what do the angels in the throne room of God have? Well, they've actually adapted to their environment because they cover their feet, which is an image of creatureliness, being a made thing, being a finite thing, and they cover their face so that their eyes will not see the glory of the Lord. I'm reading a book right now that I keep telling my colleagues about and coworkers because I just think it's so fantastic. It's called The Unsaved Christian, and it's about cultural Christianity in the Bible Belt, in mainline Protestantism, in generational Catholicism, throughout the world, how is cultural Christianity? And one of the things he often emphasizes is that they view God as a grandfatherly person in the sky who helps you when you need, but doesn't interfere when you don't. Church, let us allow Habakkuk to give us a right view of God. He's like the sun in all of his brilliance, and yet even that glory is not the whole picture. God is always greater than I imagine he is, better than I imagine he is, and more loving than I imagine he is. And so God leaves the promised land, of course, picturing it. He leaves the promised land and he goes to Egypt to save the people whom he cares about, and he's heard that they're crying. And that's where we move to verse 5. Before him went pestilence, and plague followed at his heels. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. Then the eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. Habakkuk now pictures that God is not walking to Egypt alone, but he has plague and pestilence with him. Obviously, a reference to the 10 plagues. Essentially, Habakkuk saying, this is the God who is going to easily triumph over the gods of Egypt and triumph over Pharaoh and triumph over the captivity that Israel's found in and easily deliver them. He stood and measured the earth. He looked and shook the nations. The eternal mountains were scattered. The everlasting hills sank low. His were the everlasting ways. When you look at creation, you see mountains and you see these hills and you say, this surely has existed for all time. This surely will see all of the generations of mankind go past. This alone is eternal. God approaches them, and the things we think are so eternal, so consistent in our lives, shatter, because there is only one eternal one. Once again, you might find that this is a sermon that doesn't have much application of, okay, what do I do, Pastor Josh? What am I supposed to say today? What am I supposed to think today? And I would counter that by saying, there are many passages in Scripture where the greatest application you can ever make is behold your God. So I will admit, I'm not laboring to make many applications of do this and do that. Because sometimes when we do this and do that, we neglect to look upon the God of the universe. And I will think we will find that it is much easier to do this and do that when we have a sense of the God of the universe and his presence with us and his glory. I'm really enjoying, I was way out of the loop for many years when it came to Christian worship music. And when I first got to GCA, I didn't know any of the songs. And so I would just kind of mouth it, you know, watermelon, apple, whatever you have to say to pretend like you're singing. But as I've gotten to know the songs, there's definitely things to criticize, but there's definitely something that I am very pleased with, and that is how many songs speak of the unstoppable nature of God, his omnipotence. We see songs like Waymaker. We see songs like Do It Again. We see a song literally called Unstoppable God. We need to recapture that amazement that this is a God who can do anything, and he chooses to love me. Let's move on. Verse 7. I saw the tents of Kishon in affliction. The curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Now we're moving on. God has come to get his people. He has gotten his people. And now he's taking his people back. And who stands in his way? Well, a nation named Midian. Midian stands in his way. And we get this interesting story. Some of you might know it. You might know that a donkey speaks in it. That's probably its claim to fame. There's a prophet named Balaam. And he is paid by the king of Moab and the king of Midian. Balaam goes and he is ready to curse the people of God. And only blessings come out. And so he steps back and he says, I said what I could say. The king pays him again and he speaks only blessings. And this happens 4 times. Those blessings get mounted more and more until actually there's a reference to the Messiah in this pagan prophet's speech. He calls him the coming star. Later in chapter 31, there will be payment for how Midian has treated the people of God, and Midian will face a destruction at their hands. I saw the tents of Kishon, which is just another name for Midian, in affliction. the curtains of the land of Midian did tremble. Here's what Habakkuk's saying to you. Was Midian able to stop the God of the universe who leads his people? No. Was your wrath against the rivers, O Lord? Verse 8. Was your anger against the rivers or your indignation against the sea? I used to think this was such a strange verse. Why is Habakkuk asking if God's mad at water? But I was missing the point. What happens at the very beginning of the Exodus and what happens right at the end? At the very beginning of the Exodus, God cuts the Red Sea in half and his people go by. What happens at the very end? God splits the Jordan River in half and his people go on dry land. And the interesting question is, God, were you angry at the rivers and the sea? No. God was angry at Egypt and Canaan. Was Egypt and Canaan and bodies of water and barriers able to stop the Lord Almighty? No. Look at verse 9. You strip the sheath from your bow, calling for many arrows. You split the earth with rivers. The mountains saw you and ride. The raging waters swept on. The deep gave forth its voice. It lifted its hands on high. To me, one of the more frightening verses of this, because the word bow carries a heavy weight. In Genesis 9, God has finished flooding the earth, and he says, I've put my bow in the sky. We often think, well, it just means rainbow, and it doesn't. It's the word for bow and arrow. What is God saying? The bow that was aimed down at the earth in wrath, I've placed up, hanging it on the wall of the sky, and I will use it no more. And what do we find in verse 9 and 10? God takes his bow back into his hands. A threat of a wrath of God. He won't flood the earth again, but his wrath is burning hot. In fact, all of this is flood language. You split the earth with rivers refers to a large rain that would fill up the mountainous areas of Israel and literally divide the land. It's the raging waters and the deep, and it lifts its hands, which are waves. It's this idea of flood language. Were the wicked people of Noah's day able to stop the Lord? No. Verse 11, the sun and moon stood still in their place at the light of your arrows as they sped, at the flash of your glittering spear. Another familiar story. Israel is fighting a battle, and they are facing an army. And rather than the sun turning and getting into Israel's eyes, it stands still. Could even the sun and the moon stop the power of the unstoppable God? No, but they could stop. When we look at all of this, what I hope that you will come to terms with, again, I'm not trying to convince you to do anything today. There's texts for that. There's passages for that. I hope that you will walk away from even just this section. We're not done yet, but from this section and say, there is not a single thing in my life that the God who loves me and whom I serve cannot do something about. There is nothing. Midian couldn't stop him. The waters couldn't stop him. The wicked men of Noah's day couldn't stop him. The sun and moon couldn't stop him. Why would I think that the things in my life are suddenly the area where God's strength grows weary? He is unstoppable. And so he defeats the enemies. We move on to our last section. In verse 12, we have to ask ourselves, this is a God whose glory outshines the sun, who is powerful, who views all threats as minor inconveniences that he can sweep away with a hand. This is a God who has infinite power. And what does he choose to use his power for? Verse 12, you marched through earth in a fury. You threshed a nation in anger. You went out for the salvation of your people, for the salvation of your anointed. You see, this is the mistake. If you've never had this illustration. I find it very helpful. Two illustrations to think about when you're thinking about theology, about the things we know about God and about life and about man and about salvation. The first is a pendulum. You hang something heavy on a string and you swing it. It goes far this way and then it goes far this way. We all know what a pendulum is. Why am I saying that that's like this? Because sometimes I can push the glory of God so far this way that I forget his imminence and his love for me. Or I could push it so far this way that I make him a grandfather who loves me but is not powerful. And so we have to be careful about the extremes and our tendency to always miss the mark by a little bit. The other illustration is of a highway with water on each side. If you find yourself drifting to the left, you better not overcorrect to the right. We have to be careful that this God who is glorious, who I hope you will find yourself in awe of today, knows you by name, knows every hair on your head, and uses all of that fantastic power to save you. You went out for the salvation of your people. Makes us wonder with David, Psalm 8, what is man that you are mindful of him? What is the son of man that you care for him? He says, for the salvation of your anointed. This is kind of a funny phrase. Because in the context of the Exodus, this probably refers to Moses, somebody chosen by God to save Israel. In the context of Habakkuk's day, this is probably Judah, and the meaning flips. The salvation given to your anointed, the chosen people of God. And in our day, well, we get the best of both worlds. We have the anointed one, Jesus, saving the chosen people of God, us. God uses all of that power to save us through his son. And then we get to my favorite part. Some of you know how much I make of Genesis 3:15. Actually, most of you probably do because I don't ever stop talking about it. In Genesis 3:15, we're told that there will be a son of woman who will crush the head of the serpent and he will bruise his heel. And I've found that language scattered throughout all of the Old Testament. And what do we find in here? You crushed the head of the house of the wicked, laying him bare from thigh to neck. I think what Habakkuk's doing is he's getting us out of our heads a little bit. The Exodus was not about Egypt alone. Babylon was not about Judah in this one moment alone. Your problems and the enemies you face and the suffering that you will endure, it's not about that alone. It is part of a masterpiece painting that is reaching its conclusion. The tapestry still being sewn. Because we are promised that there is a son who will crush the head of the serpent, and all serpent-shaped things will eventually get crushed. Egypt, at first, Psalms calls it a serpent, a sea serpent, crushed. Babylon, later. Ultimately, on the cross of Jesus Christ, we're told that he trampled upon the spiritual authorities, including Satan himself. It's not just about this moment. It's about what this moment has to say about all of God's work of redemption. A book I just read about serpents in the Old Testament said, you can summarize somewhat irreverently, you can summarize the entire Bible as God slays the serpent and gets the girl. And that is what we see here. The dragon lies defeated and the bride of Christ is purchased. We see that all the way in the Exodus. We see that with Babylon. We will see that on the cross. We will see that in our own lives. And we will ultimately see that in the battle where Jesus returns. And so, if I have done well, you now have a greater picture of the glory, power, and love of the God of the universe. And the question that we have to wrestle with in our last time here is, how am I supposed to respond? Look at verse 16. Habakkuk says this. He's done with theophanies. He's done with symbols. He's done with pictures. I hear and my body trembles. My lips quiver at the sound. Rottenness enters into my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. Yet I will quietly wait for the day of trouble to come upon people who invade us. What a change. I hear and my body trembles. Can I just tell you what I have appreciated about studying Habakkuk? You know, when I go to the study, I've been really trying to, I prepare the sermon for you, but then I try to preach it to myself first. I want to be as one of the congregation being affected by the word of God. And as I've preached these sermons in Habakkuk to myself, the thing that has really impacted me is just how uncomfortably honest Habakkuk is with the Lord. He doesn't lie. He doesn't hide. He doesn't make it like it's all right. Something that I tend to do, I think most of us tend to do. When Habakkuk thinks that God is acting in a way that doesn't make sense to him, he tells him. And when Habakkuk hears that Babylon will come through and destroy his nation, he recognizes that that is the right call. He recognizes that God is a merciful but wrathful God. He recognizes that the plan of God is unchangeable. It's for his glory. It's for his good. And he still doesn't lie and say, oh, well, this is good. I feel good about this. He doesn't do this stiff upper lip Christianity where whenever we walk through those doors, we can't find the sufferings of this life to be painful. That is always my concern. I tell my students this over and over again, that Christianity should not be a place, the church should not be a place where we have to pretend like the joy of the Lord in our hearts prevents us from feeling pain. I love the honesty of Habakkuk. He knows this is the right call. He knows that God is trustworthy, and he still says, when I think about these things, I tremble. My lips quiver. Rottenness enters my bones. My legs tremble beneath me. And I would encourage you that God is big enough to hear your concerns, and he is big enough to not be insecure or frightened or uncomfortable when you are hurting and you need to be honest with the Lord. I once had a mentor in college who simply said, sometimes you need to just tell God every single thing. You might say, well, all the time. Well, that's going to take a long time. Sometimes you just need to sit down and you need to tell God every single thing. Habakkuk does it, and from that he grows. We see a man who at the very beginning says, how long, O Lord, will you idly look at wrong? And by the end of the book, he says, I will quietly wait for the day. Let's move to this last part. And actually, if I were to confess to you, this is these last three verses are the whole reason that we chose Habakkuk to preach. Habakkuk is a good book. Habakkuk 3:16 through 9 or 17 through 19 might be one of the greatest words in the entirety of the scriptures. And that is a hill that I am comfortable standing on. Let's just read them without comment, without sermonic statements. Let's just read these words. Though the fig tree should not blossom, nor fruit be on the vines, the produce of the olive fail, the fields yield no food, the flock be cut off from the fold, and there be no herd in the stalls, yet I will rejoice in the Lord. I will take joy in the God of my salvation. God, the Lord, is my strength. He makes my feet like the deer's. He makes me tread on my high places. To the choir master with stringed instruments. That is a text worth memorizing, if you ask me. Because what's happening is a list of bad calamities that get worse as you go. If the fig tree doesn't blossom, that is bad. It is not the end. If there's no herds in the stalls, that is the most catastrophic. A commentator once said about this passage, if any one of these things happened, Israel would manage. If they all happen, there would be no Israel to manage at all. Habakkuk says, though all of these things happen, through total escalating loss. And then verse 18, I will rejoice in the Lord. And the Hebrew places in the Lord right after the word I. I, in the Lord, will rejoice. It reminds me of one of the truths that has really followed me throughout my life, especially once I got to college, and that is the power of our affections. Psalm 4:7, David says, you have given me more joy than when their wine vats overflow and their harvest is full. Psalm 16:11 says, there is fullness of joy at your right hand. St. Augustine says, our hearts are restless until they find their rest in you. C.S. Lewis says, we mess around with sex and drink and small pleasures like children making mud pies in a sewer who can't understand what it means to be offered a vacation at the beach. I will rejoice in the Lord. In the American church, success has infiltrated, the idea of success being the most important thing, the American dream being the way we understand reality around us. And Habakkuk 3:17 through 19 cuts through all of it and says, what happens if you have nothing? And the answer that Habakkuk gives is, I have enough. There's a woman Charles Spurgeon records doing some pastoral care with. She's very poor. He goes to the hovel she's living in, expecting to give an encouragement on not being depressed, not being sad, being satisfied with what she has. She's eating a bowl of gruel. She's this old, widowed woman, and she looks Charles Spurgeon in the eyes, and she says, all of this and Jesus too? That is the faith that Habakkuk is expressing to you. Jesus is the sole and sufficient delight of our hearts. He's enough. What we need to note about the end of this book is that it's very much like the book of Job, a book that begins with questions that go unanswered for a very long time. And then in the last moments, God doesn't say, okay, Job, let me explain to you what happened. I want you to understand in depth. Actually, doesn't explain at all. What Job needed was not the why. What Habakkuk needed was not the why. What I need is not the why. What you need is not the why. I have found, and I think that you guys all have enough experience that you can probably back me up on this. I have found that finding out the why never makes me feel better. It might mitigate it for a moment, and then the hurt comes back. Knowing why doesn't help very much. And so God doesn't bother with the why. What we need is a renewed vision, a renewed sense of who the God to whom we interact is. Just like Job hears the voice from the whirlwind reminding him that he is the creator God and all things are under his control. And just like Habakkuk hears the power of God rescuing in the Exodus, what we need is not why, it's who. Let's pray. Lord, thank you for being so gracious to us as we study the book of Habakkuk. Thank you for your kindness, for your mercy, for your greatness. Lord, I ask that this holy week would be one where we find rest from our works, we set aside dead works, and we turn our attention unflinchingly, totally, unshakably on the Son of God in power who died on our behalf and who now reigns and lives forever. Give us a renewed vision of your glory.